I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is going to be John Matteson, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Eden's Outcast, the story of Louisa May Alcott and her father. It is a page-turning biography, and I'm very excited to have him on the show. But before we talk to John, I want to introduce you to today's co-host. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Brian Yothers of the English Department here at the University of Texas, El Paso, who's going to co-host with me because you are a scholar of 19th century literature, and you're the one that turned me on to this book.
I teach 19th century American literature here at UTEP, and I specialize particularly in the works of Herman Melville and Edgar Allan Poe. And I got to know John Matteson in part because he's also a very fine scholar of Herman Melville's work, along with his very well-known biographies on Margaret Fuller and Louisa May Alcott.
And thank you for introducing me to John Matteson's work, because I probably wouldn't have encountered it before, but I love the book. I think it's amazing. It reads like a novel. But a novel with a lot of research that you trust.
Yeah. He's someone who brings together just beautiful lyrical prose with really profound research. He's spent a lot of time in Concord and a lot of time dealing with, you know, Alcott archival materials.
And I wanted you on the show with me. We talked about this. Actually, this came up at a reception, and you told me about this, right? And I said, well, let's get him on the show. But the reason why I wanted you to join me is because, you know, I'm interested in the writing process. I'm interested in the writer's life. I'm interested in the craft of, you know, putting together a story. But one of the things that I'm hoping that we can work well together is that I'll be thinking about things as, you know, from the perspective of craft, but you have this perspective of scholarship and history.
Yeah, I think it makes for a really nice tag team, especially because of the fact that we've got someone who's such a distinguished scholar and such a delight to read as a writer.
And, you know, also, I think that we're kind of... we share an interest, and our interest, I think, is literary tourism. I think sometimes we would go to a city just to visit a historical site of one of our favorite writers. Like, I went to Geneva and spent 3 days in Geneva looking for Borges's grave just because I knew it was there. And I know you do things like that. You'll go to a city just to study the footsteps of a writer.
Oh, yes. I track Melville in particular through New York, New Bedford, Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Wow. Anywhere where he put his foot down, I try to find a way to get there.
And in the book Eden's Outcast, John Matteson mentions a very literary cemetery called Sleeping Hollow. I guess it's in Boston. Have you been there? I bet you've been there.
You know, I actually haven't. I have been to Orchard House, where the Alcotts lived, and that's a lovely site with a very friendly and engaged staff. It's a wonderful place to visit if one's ever in Concord. And that, of course, is, for a 19th century Americanist, Concord is sort of the center of literary pilgrimage.
Oh, Brian, I love your enthusiasm. You get excited about books and about literature, and I think we're going to have a great discussion with John Matteson. Thank you for joining me as co-host this week.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be on Words on a Wire, which is a show that I truly love.
Oh, thank you. And so stick around. Dr. Brian Yothers and I are going to speak to Pulitzer Prize winning author John Matteson.
John Matteson is University Distinguished Professor at the City University of New York. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Eden's Outcasts and the N.M. Sperber Biography Award for The Lives of Margaret Fuller. He lives in Bronx, New York, and before his career as an academic, he was also a practicing attorney for some years. And he's a distinguished law and literature scholar as well.
John Matteson, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, I spent the last week dipping into your amazing Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Eden's Outcast, the story of Louisa May Alcott and her father. And I have to start out by asking you a kind of personal question. This is your very first book, and it won the Pulitzer Prize, which for a writer is absolutely amazing. We're lucky if our first book is even published. Tell us about, you know, how you found out about it and what it meant to you, and share that experience with us.
Oh, sure. That's fun to go back and revisit. And actually, we're coming up on the anniversary of that in a few more weeks. 10 years it's been. But anyhow, the prize came along at a really remarkable moment in my life, and a really important moment, because you know, I'd been having a little bit of personal adversity. My parents were slipping into senile dementia. My daughter was having a tough time in school. My best friend had just been checked into a mental institution, and he's fine now, but that was scary for a while. And so it was just this sort of steady string of things that kept knocking me down, and yet I kept thinking that you know there's light at the end of the tunnel. and so anyway, the day that it all broke, I don't know how much you know about the selection of Pulitzer Prize winners, but basically the biographies all get submitted to a three-person jury. And they deliberate and send three finalists to the Pulitzer Board, wow. which then announces the winner on a Monday afternoon in April. And there's no advance notice as to who is a finalist. They keep it very hush-hush.
Really?
So nobody knows anything until they have the press conference and it goes out, you know, onto the internet. And so I was absolutely not expecting anything. It was, as I say, a Monday afternoon in April. And there was actually a campus-wide faculty meeting going on because our then chancellor, Matt Goldstein, was doing his periodic tour of the City University campuses. And that happened to be John Jay's day to host him. And so he was finishing his remarks. It was around 3:30 in the afternoon. I got a tap on my shoulder, and it was our department secretary. Actually, it was somebody who had been sent in by the secretary who said, "You have to leave this room now. It's an emergency."
Oh, my God.
I thought, oh, my goodness, who's been hit by the bus? So I crept out quietly to the foyer, and there was our department secretary who said, "I'm so sorry to pull you out of the meeting, but there's an AP photographer on the way to campus. You just won the Pulitzer Prize."
Oh, my God. That has got to be the best department meeting ever.
And, you know, it was only a few days after April Fool's, and I said, okay, say that again.
Wow.
And then, you know, if you've ever seen the reaction of somebody who's just won Wimbledon or the U.S. Open, where the hands go up to the face, you sink down to the knees, that was literally what I did. And I said, okay, excuse me, I have to go back into the meeting and tell my department chair why I'm leaving. So I go in, say hi to her, say, "I'm sorry, I have to leave. I just won the Pulitzer Prize."
Oh, right? My God.
And so I walk out, and I'm going to meet the photographer, and I'm thinking, does our department secretary always get everything right? And if she's wrong on this, I've just made a fool of myself. But anyhow.
And I bet you never had to show up to a meeting after that.
Well, basically at the meeting, there was now Q&A going on for the chancellor, and our department chair rather queued up. And so he pointed to her and said, "Okay, one more question." She said, "Well, not really a question. I have an announcement to make." And so she announced it to the room, and apparently we went nuts, but wasn't there to see it. But
that's an awesome story. I love that story, especially as you know, a professor who teaches in a department, and you know that kind of honor. I understand how significant that would be, but that you heard about it while you're in a department meeting is just beautiful.
Yeah,
you got to write about that, man.
Yeah. So, and you asked too, you know, what has it meant to me? It's meant all kinds of things. It's the greatest antidepressant known to man. There's that aspect. You can really kind of look at yourself in the mirror and say, not too bad.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's given me the freedom to write the books that I'm interested in writing. Right. It's gotten me a reduced teaching load. And what's so wonderful about that is that, you know, I teach at a large, you know, urban public university where very often you're just so swamped with paper grading and course prep that you never even get to know anything about your students beyond their names
wow.
and you know, where they
yeah.
are in the grade book. And since that time, I've been able to really concentrate a lot on the very relatively few students whom I do have. And so I get to take them to museums in my spare time, and I take them to Central Park, and we sit and talk if they need it. And I've been to a student's hospital bed and the memorial service for a student's mother and things like that. And so, you know, just the status that I have has just enabled me to humanize my professional life in a way that just would not have been possible otherwise.
Well, that's beautiful. You're really doing something with it, something positive for your students and for the craft itself. Eden's Outcast is an amazing book.
Oh, thank you.
I would not have picked it up probably hadn't Brian, you know, given me a copy and told me, hey, this guy's awesome. Because, you know, I usually read poetry and fiction, but I tell you, your book is a biography on Louisa May Alcott and her father. The research, I can imagine you really geeked out on the research because there is some incredible research. But the story is compelling. The story right from the beginning is compelling. Did you write it knowing that you needed it on some level to be a page turner?
Oh, boy. You know, well, the way that I came to the book, I wasn't really necessarily expecting to write anything that would have, you know, this kind of appeal to a broad audience. But what happened was I had written an article for the New England Quarterly back in 2001, and it came to the attention of a literary agent, a really great guy by the name of Peter Steinberg, and he called me out of the blue. Says, I've read your article, like to try representing you for a nonfiction book. Oh, wow.
Geez, wow, jeez, who does that happen to?
Like Lana Turner in the drugstore, right?
Right.
So anyhow, but I said, look, I don't really have a book in mind. He said, don't worry about that. Come, we'll talk over lunch. And so it was only at that moment that I started thinking about myself as somebody who potentially could write for a non-academic audience. And from that moment, things just started falling into place. And I think one of the reasons that the book tends to strike people with a certain amount of immediacy is that I see so much of my relationship with my daughter in the relationship between Bronson and Louisa, because Bronson Alcott, as you know, was a quixotic, education-obsessed man with a verbally gifted daughter, and here I was more or less in the same shoes, and I thought, oh, hey, dummy, you can write this book, and your own personal experiences will help you kind of see between the lines of the journals and the letters, and at the same time, you're going to learn something new about parenthood that's going to possibly make you a better dad.
Right.
And so I was really kind of hoping going into it that art would inform life and vice versa. And lo and behold, I think that to a large extent is what happened.
That makes a lot of sense because there is a lot of love in this book. I mean, you love your subject.
I do. And I have come really to love the Alcotts more and more as time has gone by. And people sometimes ask me, well, how could you write so favorably of somebody like Bronson? He was a kid, and he was a little crazy and all of that. And I see that, but at the same time, I think that, you know, not only, you know, do we want to have different ways to connect with our children, and that's what the book did for me in writing it, but we also often, you know, need to kind of reconcile with our own relationships with our parents, and there can be really sort of insuperable difficulties there. And I think one of the reasons that I come at Bronson in a kind of, you know, somewhat forgiving fashion, is that I know how hard it is, you know, between children and parents, and how much we try to get through to each other, and often we just can't. And that to me is very poignant. And so so that's another reason that I was drawn to write the book in the way that I did.
So this matter of love for your subjects brings up a question for me, and it has to do with some of your other work as well.
Okay.
Because you've not only written two really superb biographies, right? Not only Eden's Outcast, but The Lives of Margaret Fuller. But you've also reflected self-consciously on the craft of writing biography in some of your reviews. And one of the things that I remember you emphasizing in a review is the idea that there's a certain humility necessary for the biographer, right? You said, you know, people read biographies because of our subjects, not just because of us, right?
Right. I think there are really very few biographers who are able to sell a book based on their appeal as writers. You go to the biography section of Barnes & Noble, you're really looking for a subject rather than an author. There are some exceptions, Robert Caro, maybe Stacey Schiff, maybe Ron Chernow, but it's a very small group of people that can sort of command that kind of audience just by putting their name on something.
And so what I was wondering was how you position yourself in relation to your subjects to establish that kind of stance of humility, right? To, in a way, let your subjects shine, even when, as in the case of Bronson Alcott, they can also have these highly frustrating qualities. One reader near to me recently said that for about the first 100 pages, she felt this recurrent desire to punch Bronson Alcott in the nose, you know? for some of his decisions. So how do you do that in terms of your self-positioning as a writer and a scholar?
Oh, boy, that's an awfully interesting question. I think that one thing that helps me is that I'm not terribly interested in ending conversations about my subjects. I'd much rather stimulate a conversation rather than try to provide all the answers. And I think that, you know, as a student and writer of fiction yourself, you can understand this, that there is a kind that, you know, it's sort of Keatsian negative capability. It's this idea that even the person writing the life or creating the character doesn't have all the answers, and it's good to leave a space that enables a reader to situate herself or himself with regard to the subject as well, and for the author to kind of, you know, tell the story and maybe shade it in particular ways, but to a large extent stay out of the way. You know, let the reader come to it, let the reader develop an understanding, and maybe have a conversation around the water cooler about it. And I think that to me is more important than driving home some particular doctrinaire dogmatic take on any of the people I write about.
I read this book almost as if it were a work of fiction, and there are so many beautiful details in here. But one of the things I really love is the character of Louisa May Alcott, and I couldn't help but think of that that quote that's attributed to both Eleanor Roosevelt and Marilyn Monroe. Nobody's sure who said it. Well-behaved women seldom make history. Did you know what she was going to be like personality-wise when you started this, or how much did you know about her, and what surprised you about her character as you were working on this book?
Yeah, you know, I knew next to nothing. I came at this project really through Bronson Alcott. My initial impulse was to write a book about 19th century utopian communities, actually, and of course, as you know, he founded such a community when Louisa was about 10 years old, this very, you know, flash-in-the-pan failed utopia called Fruitlands. But Louisa was a complete surprise package for me. It might surprise you to learn that when I started writing the book, I had not even read Little Women.
Oh, no. That is a surprise.
Yeah, I was gearing the whole thing up from scratch. And I look back on it now, and I honestly, you know, truthfully, literally don't know how I did it, because I was teaching, you know, 4 or 3 courses a semester. I was cooking dinner for my daughter, helping her with homework. And, you know, I feel sometimes as if, you know, I managed to win the Kentucky Derby while carrying the horse, you know, with all of this stuff going on. But Louisa was a revelation really at every turn. And I started to get more of a feel for that when I started making acquaintances with people at Orchard House, which is the historic home of Louisa May Alcott and Bronson in Concord, Massachusetts. And what I discovered there was these were remarkably generous, kind, nice people, you know, without exception. And it really began to feel as if some of that generous, loving spirit of the Alcotts really found its way into the way that they did their business. Now, you know that Louisa also had this very feisty, prickly side to her, and I think that's what you're saying about well-behaved women not making history. She was a remarkable free thinker at the same time that she was deeply compassionate about the people around her. And you know, one of the things that I really truly love about her is that she is this amalgam of her parents, in that she does have this kindly idealistic side that Bronson very much manifested, but she was also a tough cookie in the way that her mother was and had to be in order to shepherd the family through all of the, you know, horrific financial straits and moments of anxiety that Bronson subjected them to.
Yeah, I bet this biography has renewed, not that we need to have it renewed, but has probably renewed a lot of interest in her works, especially the last novel that you write about, Moods, where she actually got $20,000 for it, which even now is amazing for a writer.
Yeah.
but I imagine there's probably a resurgent of interest in her work, and that you're probably part of that movement.
Well, I hope that's true. We're getting a nice resurgence now because this year happens to be the 150th anniversary of the publication of Part One of Little Women.
Mm-hmm.
And the BBC is coming out with a new series, I believe, that's debuting in May. So mark your calendars for that. But what's extraordinary about Louisa May Alcott and Little Women is that the story seems to be absolutely inexhaustible, and it gets reinterpreted and represented as Hollywood film, as Broadway musical. A few years ago, there was a mashup of Little Women called Little Vampire Women, which you think was horrible, but it was really marvelous in some ways. I love the way in which the story continues to be, you know, recycled and reinvented and retold through all kinds of media. You think in terms of, you know, just the conceit of the quartet of girls or young women, right? You got that in the sitcom Facts of Life, you know, way back in the day. You've got it in Sex and the City. And that model for plot didn't exist, as far as I'm aware, before Little Women, and had no reason to. The reason there are four sisters in Little Women is that there were four sisters in the Alcott family, and each of the characters, as you know, is modeled after a real-life character, real-life person. But I love the, you know, just the many permutations that the Little Women story continues to go through.
I'm actually wanting to make a little bit of a turn to your current work. So what you've been working on lately, as I understand it, is that you've been working on Civil War literature with a special focus on five representative figures.
Yeah.
And one of them is Walt Whitman, of course, who pairs very nicely with Alcott in some ways as someone with experience in Civil War hospitals.
Right.
And I'm wondering, on the one hand, what the transition to Walt Whitman is like after spending so much time on the Alcotts and Margaret Fuller. What is it like writing about a newborn bard of the Holy Ghost, right, as Emerson would put it, and as Whitman seemed to desire to be? And I'm also just interested in hearing from you about sort of the relationship between medicine and the humanities in this current project, because that seems to be one point of connection between Whitman and Alcott.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm really thankful that I've done my book projects in the order in which I've done them, because in some ways the Alcotts are, you know, they're wonderful to work on. The documentation is copious, and they're also very straightforward people. They do not engage in a lot of guile or misdirection. Mm. That's emphatically not true of Walt Whitman, who, as you know, would tell any kind of a whopper that he could in order to sell more copies of his poems. And, you know, my favorite instance of this, there's a famous photograph of Whitman sitting in profile as a rather elderly man with what appears to be a butterfly perched on his extended index finger. And it's a charming image, and Whitman made a big deal out of it. He says, "Why, yes, little critters just love to come up to me," blah, 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 in a sort of, you know, almost Disney sort of fashion. And then you discover that after, after Whitman died and his friends and associates were rummaging through his artifacts, they discovered in a drawer the butterfly, which was made out of cardboard.
No way.
And it just stuck on his finger. And so he was really a master, well, not a master, because in some ways he was kind of transparent about it, but he was very much engaged in artifice, in the kind of crafting of literary persona that we see developed a lot more in succeeding generations with people like Mark Twain and Hemingway, where the legend becomes almost as great as the literary talent itself. And he was one of the first figures, I think, really to grasp the publicity value of being able to promote oneself in this sort of exaggerated way. So he is, in that sense, a good deal more of a challenge. He's a little bit more elusive. But at the same time, as you say, there are these resonances between the Whitman story and the Alcott story that I'm able to grab onto. One of them being that, as you've mentioned, both Whitman and Alcott acted in nursing capacities in the Civil War. She had an official army commission. He did not. But they were both driven by compassion to get involved in the war right after the Battle of Fredericksburg. And their tenure as nurses also connects very strongly with family in one way or another. Because Walt actually came down to Washington in search of his brother, who he had discovered had been wounded at Fredericksburg. And he never would have gotten involved had it not been for the wounding of George Washington Whitman. And Alcott signs up, you know, on her own. She wants something to do. She wants to help, you know, fight slavery and preserve the Union. But she's rescued. Her life is actually saved by Bronson, who comes down to Washington after she's fallen into a horrible illness, typhoid pneumonia, and he literally saves her life by bringing her home. So there's this recurring theme of the search for family that to me is really very, very arresting as well.
You know, what you just did with Walt Whitman, and, you know, of course, I love poetry and I love writing, so obviously I'm going to have my love affair with Walt Whitman, but what you just did is you made him, you humanized him for me with that butterfly story. You made me care about him, and that's what you do with Louisa May Alcott, and that's what you do with Bronson. And I imagine as you're writing their narratives, what happens in fiction happens in nonfiction, and we come up with these incredibly big plot twists that we didn't know about. And I'm thinking in particular about the coincidence of Louisa May Alcott and her father having the same birthday, and then the other coincidence that you say for the last chapter. I'm not quite sure if you want me to reveal that other coincidence.
Okay, we'll leave it as a cliffhanger.
yeah, because it's a perfect one, and I would hate to ruin that for the reader.
Okay.
But do you find yourself, as you're researching the stories, that there are so many plot twists that you have to almost feel like you have to justify it so people believe it?
Well, I have a colleague who's fond of saying that nobody writes better plots than God. that you know, people have often said fact is stranger than fiction, and I find it, you know, in many ways more fascinating than fiction. And it's very true that some of the extraordinary coincidences and occurrences that take place are really what, you know, make my work for me, in a sense. Yeah. I would love to be a novelist. I think it would be great if I could write fiction, but I can't come up with original characters or plots to save my skin. And so what I do instead is, you know, I go into an archive, you know, give me some letters and some journals, and I'll tell you a story. And I take tremendous delight in bringing to it a kind of, dare I say, you know, narrative vitality. But often I just feel that I'm just sort of taking the stuff that's already there and stringing it together.
Right, right. And I suppose you follow language, you follow research, you follow story, then you kind of follow this incredible narrative that existed without you, and you just need to put it together in such a way that presents the magic that is life.
Yeah, very true. And you can't necessarily do that with every single life that you want to render. One of the things that Lives of Margaret Fuller and Eden's Outcast have in common is that they both have real slam-bang endings, you know, not willing to give away too much.
Right, right.
Whereas, and I think Brian's going to sympathize with this, I don't think that I would ever go near writing a biography of Herman Melville. Because the story arc it's great up until the publication of Moby Dick. And then you've got 40 years, you know, during which there's this slow decline, and he's working in the customs house, and it really just kind of peters out.
Wow.
Not entirely, because you've got Billy Budd at the end and so forth. But very much what I'm always looking for is some kind of story arc that's, you know, going to build to a climax and then have a denouement, very much as one would go about crafting a novel. So that's not coincidence.
Well, John, we're out of time, but I'd like to thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. I wish we had more time, because Brian and I had a little meeting before we recorded, and we all have like 20 questions, 19 of which we didn't get to yet.
Well, if you ever want to do part two, you know, I'm more than happy to come back, because this has been a delight.
Well, you've been a pleasure to talk to. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Okay, pleasure indeed. Take care.
I'd like to thank our guest, John Matteson, for joining us on Words on a Wire. The book is Eden's Outcast. It is a fantastic read. And Dr. Brian Yothers, thank you for co-hosting.
Thank you so much for having me, Daniel. It's a real pleasure.
And thank you for introducing me to this book. And anytime you have a book you think I should read, pass it my way, because I trust your opinion.
I will do that.
I'd like to thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, and we'll see you next week on Words on a Wire.